Iran condemns German and French statements over the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian woman at the entrance of a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Denmark is holding a referendum that could boost militarization in the European Union. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran condemns German and French statements over the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the statements as one-sided and unjustifiable. Said Khatibzadeh says Paris and Berlin should stop defending the vessels that violated the maritime norm and instead uphold legal proceedings based on international laws. German and French foreign ministries had separately criticized the seizure of Greek tankers, calling it a violation of international regulations. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the vessels on Friday. The incident came just days after Greece confiscated an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered it to the U.S. Iran slammed the move as a violation of international law and called for immediate release of the vessel and its cargo. Meanwhile, Greek environmental groups have condemned Athens for causing an oil spill during the transfer of Iranian oil.
Greek authorities impounded an Iranian flag tanker carrying oil earlier this month, citing U.S. sanctions on Iran. The United States later confiscated the oil on board. Iran's foreign ministry on Wednesday summoned the Greek chargé d'affaires to protest the seizure of the Iranian flagged vessel and confiscation of crude cargo in the European country's territorial waters. The ministry condemned Greece's unacceptable surrender to illegal U.S. pressures and said the seizure of the cargo of the ship with the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran was an example of international piracy.
Well, the Greek authorities have acted evidently under instructions from the United States, and probably they don't even have an explanation. They just executed what they were requested, as it always happens with countries that are under the patronage of the United States. So the situation is always the same. The United States decides who should be punished, and there are some executors.
Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization issued a statement also describing the move as an act of piracy that was in violation of international standards. According to the statement, the vessel had faced adverse weather conditions and experienced some technical problems which led it to call for assistance. Under international and technical regulations and standards, the state with the nearest coastline to the vessel calling for assistance due to safety threats, which was in this case Greece, should have cooperated by guiding the vessel to a place of safety where the problems could be resolved before sending it off on its international voyage.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf on Friday, citing maritime violations. Although the incident came right on the heels of Greece's confiscation of an Iranian tanker, countries such as France were quick to condemn Iran, whereas they remained silent in the face of Greece's naval seizure. But what can explain such double standards? Let's have a look.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released a video of the recent seizure of two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows IRGC's heli-borne special forces boarding the Greek ships ahead of their seizure over violations in the waters of the Persian Gulf. Iran's foreign ministry said one of the vessels, the Delta Poseidon, was sailing international waters at the time, adding that the second tanker was near the Iranian coast when seized. The ministry also said nine Greeks were among the crews of both vessels, but did not give a number of the other sailors on board. Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization said on Saturday that the crews of the two Greek oil tankers are not detained but are aboard the vessels and in good health. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken labeled the seizure as unjustified, calling for the release of the tankers and their crews. France, too, called it, quote, a serious violation of international law, while making no mention of the seized Iranian tanker. The seizure of an Iranian oil tanker comes as talks for the revival of the 2015 deal remain stalled.
Well, evidently they've calculated that exerting what they call the maximum pressure on Iran is the necessary thing to do in order to obtain the maximum during the negotiations. It is something that it's difficult to evaluate, but evidently is not a friendly move. Is an indication of the fact that for them, Iran still is under sanctions and therefore to be excluded from international trade in energy, in the energy sector.
The U.S. administration claims it wants to see the JCPOA restored, but actions speak louder than words.
Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian woman in the occupied West Bank town of Al-Khalil. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli soldiers opened fire at 31-year-old Ofran Warasna at the entrance of the Al-Arub refugee camp. The Israeli military claims she was carrying a knife and approaching soldiers, the Red Crescent says. The regime's forces prevented medics from reaching injured Warasna until after 20 minutes of the shooting. Israel has recently escalated its deadly attacks against Palestinians. In the occupied territories, more than 50 Palestinians, including prominent journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, have been killed since the start of this year. Correspondent in Ramallah Mona Kandil joined us earlier with an update on the Israeli shooting. She says the regime soldiers could have stopped the Palestinian woman if there was a threat, but they fatally shot her without remorse.
The Israeli military claims that Ofran arrived at a semi-checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Arub refugee camp, and she was wielding a knife. This is the Israeli story. And just before she approached even the Israeli soldiers who were conducting, let's say, security search in the area, and in order to make sure that the roads are safety, because these roads are used by Israeli settlers, even if they are at the entrance to the Palestinian refugee camps and Palestinian towns. Immediately, one of the Israeli soldiers decided to shoot her with the live fire. According to the international law, and in case Israeli soldiers or any soldiers felt, let's say, threatened, they could use their fire to hinder the movement, let's say, so-called attacker. But in this case, they are claiming that she had a knife. They are claiming that she tried to approach them. And before even she arrived at the checkpoint, she opened fire at her to kill her, not to hinder her movement, to arrest her and question her to see if she was what she was going to do.
The Turkish president has once again threatened that his country will carry out a military offensive across the border in Syria. Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey will rid Tal Rifat and Manbij areas in northern Syria of what he called terrorists, an indirect reference to Kurdish militants. He added that Ankara's planned operations will gradually continue in other parts of northern Syria. He said the move is in line with Turkey's plan to establish a 30-kilometer security zone in Syria. Damascus has condemned Ankara's plan to establish the zone as an act of aggression and extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. And in Denmark, people are voting in a referendum on whether to scrap their country's decades-old policy of not joining the European Union's common defense policy. Denmark is the only EU member that has a so-called defense reservation and is not bound by the bloc's common security and defense policy. However, recent polls suggest Danes will vote in favor of abolishing the existing norm. The referendum comes as more European countries have been seeking closer military ties and increasing their defense spending since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. In the latest example, Sweden and Finland have applied for NATO membership, whereas Germany has decided to release more than $100 billion to modernize its army. Russia widening its gas cuts to Europe. Denmark is the latest to see a halt in gas supply in response to its refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The Danish energy company says it has been informed by Russia's energy giant Gazprom about its decision. That's the day after Gazprom turned off its supplies to the top Dutch trader. Denmark says, however, that it has restored enough gas and could buy more from the European market. Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland, citing their failure to make payments in rubles. Moscow's measure comes in response to a host of sanctions the European Union has imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine. On Monday, the bloc also agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and slash Russia's largest bank from the SWIFT system. The new sanctions sent Brent crude prices soaring to $122 a barrel. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says that Europe will suffer more from the economic war it has launched against Russia. Take a listen.
Well, it comes down to substance. Russia has material. It has trees. It has oil. It has gas. It has gold. It has food. It has fertilizer. It has the substance of life. Europe has nothing but credit systems and banking systems. And really, credit doesn't matter when you have a war situation. The only thing that matters is material substance. So Europe is basing all of its policy on the hot air and the fantasy that it is, it is essential. It is some sort of social hub that unites all of civilization. And it is not. Russia is faring far better than any other country. The ruble is at record highs. Half the world agrees with Russia. Only European countries do not. And that's really based on a vanity and a silly, soft, pacifist culture that has grown in Europe like a cancer because of the nanny state that the United States has imposed upon it. But if these countries are trying to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas, perhaps the best thing for Russia to do is to wean them off quickly by yanking the spigot out of their, out of their economies, and letting them get to that place all the more faster. They really want to wean themselves off. Russia has no problem cutting them off tomorrow from every barrel of oil and every container of gas, and sell it to China, sell it to India, sell it to South America, sell it to South Africa, sell it to other nations.
Russia has accused the United States of adding fuel to the fire by planning to supply Ukraine with advanced missile systems. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the U.S. action deliberate and on purpose. He said such arms supplies don't encourage Kiev to resume peace talks. The spokesman also noted that Washington is using Ukrainian lives in order to maintain its fight against Moscow. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with advanced rocket systems that can strike with precision at long-range Russian targets. This is part of an additional U.S. military aid worth $700 million, which the White House says is aimed at helping Ukraine at the negotiating table with Russia. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be used to target and kill civilians.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbas people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
China has conducted a combat readiness sea and air patrol around Taiwan in response to what it calls collusion between the United States and the self-ruled island. In a statement, the Chinese military has criticized U.S. for supporting Taiwanese forces, warning that such measures will put the island into a dangerous situation. The statement says the Chinese forces will strengthen their readiness to foil actions by those supporting Taiwan's independence. China's maneuver comes a day after the Taiwanese president acknowledged about plans for cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, but the U.S. has increased its military and diplomatic ties with Taipei. President Joe Biden also angered China recently after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if it's attacked by China. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7th, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, "I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop."
The electoral events in the US and the notoriously scandalous failures of the hubristic and arrogant managers in that country, the unsuccessful one-year fight against the pandemic in the US and Europe, and the embarrassing incidents that ensued, and also the recent political and social instabilities in the most important European countries, are all signs of the downward movement of the Western camp. On the other hand, the growth of the resistance forces in the most sensitive Islamic regions, the development of their defensive and offensive capabilities, their growth of self-awareness, motivation, and hope in Muslim nations, the increasing tendency to follow Islamic and Quranic slogans, and the growth of independence and self-reliance in nations are auspicious signs of a better future.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
In this auspicious future, cooperation between Muslim countries should be a main and fundamental goal, and this does not seem unlikely. The pivot around which this cooperation turns is the issue of Palestine, the entirety of that country, and the fate of Holy Quds. This is the same truth that guided the enlightened heart of the great Imam Khomeini, may God bestow mercy upon him, towards the announcement of International Quds Day on the last Friday of Ramadan. Cooperation between Muslims around the pivot of Holy Quds is an absolute nightmare for the Zionists and for their American and European advocates. The failed project called the Deal of the Century and the effort to normalize the relations between a few weak Arab governments and the Zionist regime were desperate attempts to run away from that nightmare.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Dozens of Palestinians have been injured during clashes with Israeli forces and illegal settlers throughout the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds, where Israeli extremists staged a hugely controversial march. This year's march was reportedly partaken by around 25,000 settlers, who were being accompanied and protected by Israeli forces. The settlers were heard chanting Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian slogans such as "Death to Arabs" and "Shireen is dead," referring to veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla, who was assassinated by the Israeli military earlier this month. The Israeli settlers forced their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, performing religious rituals there. At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that the so-called flag march in occupied East Al-Quds is a grave provocation against the Palestinian people and the Arab and Islamic nations, stating that the resistance will not hesitate to perform its duty of defending Palestinian sanctities and people. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates has condemned the Israeli settlers' latest raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, saying the Tel Aviv regime is fanning the flames of religious tensions by allowing such incursions into the holy site. Also, Iran has condemned Israeli forces' desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and their attacks on Palestinians there. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh warned against Tel Aviv's latest adventurism and provocative moves. He praised Palestinian people's resistance against the regime and recalled the Palestinian cause as the top priority of the Muslim world. He said all freedom-seeking people around the world, especially the people and governments of Muslim countries, have a duty to join hands to wholeheartedly defend Al-Quds and stand up to the apartheid Israeli regime. The spokesman also called on the international community and organizations to fulfill their legal responsibility by stopping Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
The idea of a national Israeli day is a sign of a group of colonists living in the past. They think they are living a century ago. It is a disgrace in today's world, of course, where we are supposedly past the era of colonialism, rejecting the idea of apartheid. And the responsibility for this, of course, does lie on the colonists themselves, but it also lies on the sponsors of that colony. There would not be an apartheid colony in Palestine today were it not for the fact that many of the NATO states, in particular Britain, France and the USA, are the sponsors of this colonization, this apartheid. The situation would be resolved a long time ago if those NATO sponsors had not been supporting this regime for so long.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, known to Jews as the Temple Mount and located in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, is a flashpoint. Under a 1967 deal between Israel and Jordan, the compound's custodian, non-Muslim worship is prohibited at the site. In defiance of the agreement, Israel allows settlers to enter the site and carry out religious rituals. Recently, there has been a sheer escalation of atrocities by the Israeli regime against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Outraged by the Israeli aggression, Palestinian resistance groups have intensified their operations throughout the occupied territories. The clashes in Al-Quds had sparked fears of another armed conflict similar to an 11-day war in May last year between Israel and Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas.
But they don't understand really that the resistance that they provoke is the main reason why that regime is going to fall. The first reason that apartheid is going to be dismantled in colonized Palestine is because the resistance has been so persistent, so steadfast and so constant. The second reason is the delegitimization of this apartheid colony internationally. It is repulsing already people around the world. It's even repulsing many Jewish people.
Some around the world could argue it's only a flag parade and nothing more, but for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line and they will always defend it with all means possible. A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally, saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on a stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and use the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack.
I was just devastated. It's heart-rendering for us as grandparents. We have children in the age vicinity that happened here. It's overwhelming.
In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed.
Why are you here? If not to solve a problem as existential as this. This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
So to me, it's really two factors. It's troubled kids, troubled young people, and guns. And every country has troubled young people to some extent, but not every country has a system where you can get guns so easily.
The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people.
The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, can't say anything about it because the colonial mode of production, the violence that's required by the colonial mode of production is what is the lifeblood for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society.
So, no, there is no irony that the biggest purveyor of colonial violence is also the biggest supplier of guns. That's why they have hundreds of military installations. They, being the United States, has hundreds of military installations around the world. Army, Air Force, Marines, and the Coast Guard, whatever else they have. And even within the United States borders, the police department, sheriff department, the marshals, all those instruments of violence exist.
The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdollahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام قل الحق وإن كان فيه هلاكك فإن فيه نجاتك، ودع الباطل وإن كان فيه نجاتك فإن فيه هلاكك.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, speak the truth even if it entails your own ruin, for verily your deliverance is therein, and abandon falsehood even if it entails your deliverance, for truly therein is your ruin.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the golden dialogues of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence talked about worshipping when it came to the conversations and the dialogues with his friends, his family members, and his relatives. And when it comes to worshipping, of course, we find that Imam al-Qasim, he spoke to his companions and he spoke to his relatives and the people in general. He taught them via these conversations that worshipping Allah is something that has no limits. Now, this might seem a little bit strange to us, and we might think, well, how is it possible that worshipping Allah has no limits? But interestingly, it is true. For if we look at the way that worshipping is and its essence, we worship Allah based upon the fact that He deserves to be worshipped. Now, how much does Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, truly deserve to be worshipped? Well, the limits to the worship that Allah deserves is truly limitless. And so in this conversation, Imam al-Qadhim says to his companion, do not take out of yourself this idea that you are falling short of worshipping Allah. For surely, all the worship that is assigned to Allah, the Great, the Almighty, is worship that is less than what is due to Him. And so in this response to this question from his companion asking him about the limits of worship, we find that Imam al-Qadhim really said that no matter how much we worship Allah, it is less than what Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, deserves. Of course, when you start to think about the attributes of Allah, you do realize that no matter how much we worship Allah, it is less than what is truly due to Him. And so, dear friends, we should try our best to worship Allah as much as we can, but with sincerity, with a purity of heart, and a purity of intention. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Qadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam al-Qadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The period of the leadership of Imam al-Qadhim, salamullah alayhi, in this timeline of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt after they no longer had governance, they no longer ruled after Imam al-Mujtaba's few months. The movement arrived at a very critical moment at the time of Imam al-Qadhim, salamullah alayhi. That moment is that while the people were encouraged to rise for justice, rise to have Islam rule, to have the Quran rule, to have those who know the Quran rule, to have those who know the Prophet and his Sunnah to rule, to have those that the Prophet said, they along with the Quran I'm leaving behind. And if you grab a hold of these two, the Quran and Itrati Ahla Bayti, you will not be lost. They were encouraging the people, educating the people, spreading this information from Islam about what is correct authority and rule in Islam and what is injustice and what the people's responsibility towards it is. This movement had begun and it had reached a point where people were willing to come out and rise, and they were willing to come and sacrifice, they were willing to fight. They did come forward. Thank you.
listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Part 2.
Here in Kiev in recent days, the Maidan, Independence Square, has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or